When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
we still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
All right, welcome, Zero Books readers and viewers. This is the Zero Books live stream and podcast. Today I have Matt McManus and Marian Trejo on the live stream to discuss their book, which is a collection of essays and also features essays from Conrad Hamilton and our own Ben Burgess from Give Them an Argument fame. And it's coming out next month, so I wanted to get to work promoting this book, but it's a critique of Jordan Peterson called It's Myth and Mayhem, a critique of Jordan Peterson from the left. And I'm glad to be talking about something other than COVID-19 and get a chance to talk to you both. So I guess to start with, I should just ask you, what motivated you to put together this collection of critical essays on Peterson?
Oh, yeah, thank you very much. And yeah. I'm glad you're safe. And we hope all the readers and listeners are keeping safe, practicing social distancing, and finding ways to kind of keep in touch with everyone else, despite all the kind of isolation that we seem to be going through right now. And right now, we're living in my brother's basement and can't wait to get out a little bit. But the reason why we decided to write this was just because back in 2017, when I first heard about Jordan Peterson, it was right around the time when I was wrapping up my PhD, I was kind of just shocked by how quickly he kind of ascended to the spotlight. And it kind of made me think a little bit more about the various kinds of social justice activism, what Mark Fisher calls the vampire castle on the left might have done to provoke some of this. And so being, you know, an academic, I decided, well, let's take a crack at some of his work and see what's going on in there and what his actual arguments are for some of these positions. And what I found when I started reading Maps of Meaning and then later 12 Rules for Life and his other papers was that he represented this very distinctively reactionary approach to the problems of modernity. And this didn't mean that there weren't gems of insight that were scattered within his work, particularly when it came to various different ways people had reacted to the problems posed by modernity by turning to cynicism on the one hand or totalitarianism on the other. But I also felt that a lot of the solutions that he was putting forward were decidedly flawed or just outright wrong. And they were wrong in interesting ways. And that's always a good hook for any kind of academic. You want somebody to be wrong, but in interesting ways and have a few germs of insight that are worth interrogating. And that was kind of the genesis of the book. I knew that I wanted Marian to get involved pretty early on to bring her perspective. You know, Ben and I have worked together for quite some time on various different pieces, and I knew he would bring a real clarity of exposition and a sense of humor to the text. And I thought Conrad would do a good job elaborating on some of the more particular problems that Peterson's analysis have when it comes to postmodern or Marxist theory.
So Marian, I want to ask you something. Did you first encounter Peterson through Matt, or had you encountered Jordan Peterson on your own, and what interested you about his work, if anything?
Yeah, no, I encountered Peterson because of Matt. As you
mentioned, my bad influence.
Yeah. We were living in Mexico as of last week, so like it was quite a remote figure for me. And what motivated me to join the book was the fact that when I started reading Peterson and also looking at his media presence, he sounded, although he's Canadian and an academic, his critique and his what makes him uncomfortable, it's very similar of some of the discussions that are being that I have or I have seen in Mexico about, for example, feminism or the left. So I thought it was very interesting in that way, you know, like how there are parallels between these discussions in places as different as Canada and Mexico.
I would say some of our students were really interested in him also. That was part of the motivation for me, because there's kind of a burgeoning feminist movement at Tech de Monterey, and where there's a burgeoning feminist movement, there's also a kind of burgeoning masculist movement, if you want, as we've talked about at some length. So know, that kind of was a motivation as well.
Right. So why don't you both explain what your particular contributions were to the book? There's four essays in the book. They do cohere. They kind of hang together, but they're also very different lines of attack on Peterson's work. So whichever one of you wants to go first, why don't you explain what your tact was as you approached Peterson?
What I wanted to address was basically his uneasiness with feminism, right? Like, what interested me was that Peterson constantly says that he is not an anti-feminist, but at the same time, he has very rooted anti-feminist feelings. So I wanted him to look at what was going on there, right? That he says like, oh, I'm not an anti-feminist, but he is indeed. So I wanted to see what was exactly his position towards feminism. What is it that made him uncomfortable, right? Like, and if it was like deep, like if it was only like being like discomfort, or if it was like any theoretical substance, for example, to what was he saying, that was also of interest. So I'm not gonna like go into details into that because I know we're gonna discuss it later. So that's
yeah. I'm kind of tempted to just push Matt to the side for a minute and just discuss the feminism. But in fact, Matt, I'm going to do that to you. Why don't we hold off on your perspective? And I just want to ask you, what do you think it is to be an anti-feminist particularly? Is there a political ideology or a particular anti-feminist theoretical position that you could test Peterson against? Or is it just sort of a reaction to feminism that, you know, that there can be a plurality of anti-feminisms?
I think it's a reaction, certainly. I don't see any of this as a kind of coherent ideology at all. I can see some sort of coherent like sentiment, as you mentioned, right? Like as Matt already previewed the idea of like this deep defense of like masculinity, right? And like of traditional masculinity, like it's also like I think a sense of the fact that their identity is being destabilized is also like an homogeneous sentiment. But I see it like as shared feelings, as shared sentiments, as deep like uneasiness to how the world is changing, and also
they have some talking points, these anti-feminists, that they maybe share in common, even if they don't share an ideology or a deep critique.
Yeah,
like some of them would be things like, let's see, feminism is largely about tearing down men or trying to destroy masculinity. The feminists are special pleading, and when if you want to look to an explanation of the pay gap, you have to look at their own choices and what women are naturally inclined to do. These are talking points. These are not my opinions, right? Patriarchy either doesn't exist or it's good. That would be another talking point. Is there one that I'm missing that I ought to bring up that kind of defines a broad anti-feminist perspective today, do you think?
No, I think you covered it quite well. Let me see. I will say that like differences are like gender differences are natural. That's basically like the core, like one of the cores, right? And I have to say, like, what, like, 2018 and 2019 was a great year for feminism in Latin America, for feminist movements. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of protest, a lot of antagonism with the governments. So I think in the case of at least of Latin America, what I can see in my own experience will be like, for example, it's still an issue of a problematic issue in the West, but in most of Latin American countries haven't legalized abortion or give access to abortion, right? Decriminalized abortion. So I think like a shared feeling among these anti-feminists that abortion is wrong, right? That abortion is just like women like that don't want to be responsible of their own sexuality, right? Of the consequences of living a free, sexuality. I think I will say, at least for Latin America, that will be like a strong point of like disagreement and agreement on the side of like anti-feminist. And also like, I think also a perception of feminists as like very angry women, right? Like, I will say that was also like a common one.
Yeah.
It's ironic, since so many of the Peterson fans that you receive correspondence with tend to be very angry men. So,
yeah. So, in your essay, you critique Peterson for kind of presenting feminism in this really abstract way. Basically, Peterson's understanding of feminism is not that different than, his understanding of Marxism. In other words, it's a caricature at best. What school or tendency do you feel that you're aligned with in the feminist tradition? And because there's a multitude of feminisms. And when you said that it's been the last 2 years have been very good for the struggle, for women's struggle in Mexico. What do you have a particular kind of a feminism in mind when you say that? Is it just a kind of the feminist struggle for liberal rights and bodily autonomy, which is really what the abortion issue is about? Or is there a particular school of thought that is dominating and leading an active feminism in Mexico?
Yeah, well, just to answer the first question, I was talking to Matt like really about this before this, and I think I have struggled to pin down myself. If I had to give it like a label to quickly associate me, I think with like socialist feminist. Just because a Marxist feminist comes with a lot of, also problems, but the socialist feminist too, but I will say that I'm a socialist feminist myself, although as a master's degree, I did study a lot of Foucault, that was my thesis about, so mm-hmm. I think also to highlight, for example, the microphysics of power and the discipline of bodies, or for example, the biopolitical, aspects of, like, gender, right, like, but mostly mostly like a socialist feminist. I do believe that like gender oppression is just as important, right? As
sounds like you're one of those neo-Marxist postmodern feminists to me.
Probably I embody that category. We've been saying that it doesn't exist.
You're one of those that don't exist. Okay, so. Now, what you said that there was a problem with Marxist feminism or something about it that you didn't quite want to align with. What would you say that your hesitation is around Marxist feminism as opposed to socialist feminism?
Well, I think, theoretically, there are there's so much diversity that it's hard to, tell you, right, like what is exactly like a Marxist or a socialist feminist. I will say that just with Marxist feminism, what I see or when encountering, for example, Marxists, they don't think that you are truly a Marxist, right? And when you encounter feminists and when you say that you're a Marxist feminist, they don't think you're truly a feminist. I don't know. I think it's, of course, of a lot of people with content.
Why would a Marxist not accept a Marxist feminist as a Marxist, do you think?
I think maybe it's just because, honestly, this is just coming from a broad generalization. because a lot of the Marxists that we've encountered are like very orthodox, right? Like very, very orthodox Marxists, not critical Marxists, right? The ones that don't know class struggle is the like the single most important type of struggle, right? So when you try to bring other types of struggle into question, they have you think that you are trying to dissolve kind of like the revolution, right? Instead of trying to understand that you actually want to make it like a little bit broader so that other people can be included into like a revolutionary like sentiment or movement or whatever, right? So I think that's the issue. I understand that there are a lot of people, and certainly like joining Zero was great because I saw like other people, right, that were in like in this vein. But when we attend conferences or when we engage with some people, right, like there's this tendency of like I think extreme partisanship, right? So that's what I was saying.
And why would feminists not accept a Marxist feminist then? Just because they see a Marxist feminist as being a class reductionist?
Yeah, I think that would be the main thing, yes.
Mm-hmm. I should say also, this is a fairly typical problem in Latin America that you and I have complained about a little bit, where I think things haven't necessarily changed as much as they have in some other departments, where it's a little bit easier to be a Marxist and then a feminist or a Marxist committed to critical race theory. The demarcations are still a little bit more strict. And I think if you look at the president of Mexico, AMLO, and his record on some women's issues, that will tell you quite a bit, if you want, about how sharply these lines are still drawn in some parts of the world.
Right. Okay, well, I have other questions for you, Miriam, but I want to come back to them. I want to give Matt, he's sitting there. He's been very good. He hasn't spoken. He's a white male, though, and I know he really wants to talk. So, and as a white male in solidarity, I want to give him some time. So Matt, what is the thrust of your argument against Jordan Peterson, in the book?
Well, I should say, right off the bat that I do think that Jordan Peterson is an intelligent and articulate man. Some of my co-authors don't agree with me on that. And, you can hear their reasons for this, but I've always had a soft spot for Jung and Nietzsche and Heidegger. And I do think that they have important things to teach people on the political left. So I'm not opposed to somebody engaging in that kind of scholarship. The two problems that I've had with his analysis, and these are fairly general categories, you know, there's a lot of variation within them, is that one...
Matt, I just want you to know I am alerting my Marxist cadre about your trip to Gulag later for embracing Heidegger in particular. But anyway, keep going.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to wind up in a Solzhenitsyn, you know, parable very soon. I think that there are two prongs to his analysis that are flawed, right? The first is that Peterson just doesn't really have a very firm understanding of the political left. You know, Marian already talked about some of the ways in which his analysis of feminist discourse, which is an extremely robust and complicated field with a lot of debate going on within it, is highly reductionist. And I don't really take that on in my own section, but I certainly do talk about how his interpretation of left-wing theorists is extremely flawed, particularly people like Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida. You know, Michel Foucault famously said, "I am a Nietzschean." Certainly not, "I am a Marxist." And if anything, Peterson, you'd think, would sympathize with some of that, given his own proclivity to like Nietzsche. Jacques Derrida, much more influenced by people like Saussure and Heidegger and Husserl, to a more ambiguous extent, the Jewish theological tradition. And you can find these kind of weird errors in a lot of his interpretation of left-wing philosophy. And probably no more grandly than when it comes to his interpretation of Marx. I mean, Ben Burr just talks about this in his essay, where he points out that there was this kind of shocking moment where Peterson admits that despite the fact that he rails on and on about Marx, he hadn't actually read anything except for the Communist Manifesto in 20 years, 30 years since he was 18 years old. And it really shows in his interpretation of these figures.
Yeah.
The thing that I'd like to point out is that I think he doesn't really get left-wing activism correct. And it's important to distinguish between left-wing activism and left-wing theory. He tends to assume that there's this through line between postmodern theorizing and identity politics. And I don't think that's the case either. I mean, certainly there are a lot of left-wing activists out there who are influenced by Foucault, influenced by Derrida, influenced by intersectionality. But a lot of the time, they don't necessarily need this theorizing to engage in the kind of activism that they're doing. And even to the extent that they do draw on these figures, it's not a one-to-one association. It's a lot more complicated than that. And drawing on my other book for Zero, the What is Postmodern Conservatism book, I say that's because the kind of identity politics movements we see emerging right now, or what David Harvey calls militant particularism, since I like that word better, owes a lot more to postmodern culture generally than postmodern theory specifically. And we need to understand that and look at the material, political, and ideological conditions of postmodernity to really understand why these movements emerge. Not say that somehow reading Jacques Derrida turns you into some raging SJW who's going to go out there and just start criticizing everybody for using the wrong pronouns, right?
So I want to ask you about intersectionality. Would you say that intersectionality is a kind of postmodern theory?
I don't necessarily think so, no. I mean, if you look at Kimberly Crenshaw, who pioneered the approach, certainly she draws on various forms of radical theorizing, some of which have an association with postmodern thought, but she owes a lot more to the civil rights movement and the effort to try to show how it is that these movements have achieved a great deal for the emancipation of traditionally marginalized communities, particularly racialized communities, but at the same time, they've missed out on a lot of people within that community who aren't necessarily given the attention they deserve. And her famous example is a Black woman, right? And she talks about how the traditional civil rights movement did a great deal to advance the cause of African Americans, but the legal changes that they were able to enact still discriminate against many African American women, not because of, you know, the civil rights movement, but because the powers that be didn't really want to take the necessary reforms in order to improve the situation. And so she's trying to say that we need a much more dynamic and multifaceted interpretation of power and discrimination to really fine-grain our analysis of the ways that people are still discriminated against, despite the fact that there's been major reforms, certainly since the 1950s and 60s.
Wouldn't you say that Kimberly Crenshaw's theory of intersectionality is basically a liberal rights-based theory, legal theory?
I certainly think it can be married to that. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people I knew in social legal studies who endeavor to do just that. And I have a certain fondness for human rights, and I've often engaged in this kind of activism, right?
Didn't she come out of legal theory? And wasn't it a case, a labor rights case that she, that the
I'm not sure if it was a labor rights case. Her paper referred to the history of American jurisprudence and legal reform when it came to African Americans, right? And she was
I thought it was about women workers at General Motors who had been let go after the economic crisis in the 70s. And because they were one of the first, they were the most recent hires because they'd been hired after civil rights legislation had been put through to force those kinds of hires. They were the first to be let go when there was an economic crisis. And this was thought to be and argued to be discrimination. But they argued the company defended itself by saying, no, look, we've had Black workers for a long, long time. This wasn't a matter of discrimination. And their point was, yeah, you've had Black male workers on the assembly line, but you haven't had Black secretaries and women working here. And so you have to be intersectional in the way you look at the argument for discrimination.
No, that's exactly right. And this is the example that she uses in her seminal paper pioneering this theory, right?
Right.
As the fact that the women in these kind of contexts are kind of slammed twice, if you want. They were historically slammed because they were African-American at a time when the United States was a highly racist country, still is in many ways, sadly. And they were also slammed for being women. And it's important not to conflate the struggle for emancipation for both of these intersectional categories together and imply that just achieving emancipation for one of these groups is achieving emancipation for both.
But I mean, it wasn't just that they were like slammed, or insulted, but they were fired. They were let go. And it was it wasn't the original kind of, I mean, in her paper, that was a labor struggle, and one in which they were trying to argue for discrimination as a way to redress the fact that they had been made unemployed.
Oh, absolutely. And if you want another good example, one of the ways intersectional theory has been used to advance a kind of liberal rights discourse is actually in Canada, where Jordan Peterson obviously got his start from. But I don't really think he understands the benefits that accrued from this kind of analysis, at least from a formal standpoint. So what a lot of people started to do, for instance, in the early 2000s, when there was this wave of Islamophobia that was being carried out because of 9/11 and fears about Muslim interrogation and so on, was people started to say, look, like, we need to make sure that when we're talking about integrating Muslims into Canadian society and granting them the same rights as everyone else and so on and so forth, that we recognize that there is a distinction between the gender in some of the between genders in some of these groups, and we can't just conflate them together into one. We need to look at the interests of Islamic women separately from the interests of Islamic men, and not necessarily imply that just advancing rights discourse for one of them means advancing rights discourse for two. And it produced a lot of interesting case law on how it is that you try to reconcile what are sometimes competing objectives. For instance, tolerance for various different cultural groups, while at the same time enabling people who want to agitate for reform from within these cultural groups to have the space to do so safely. And with a bit of heft behind their back.
Yeah. Well, I guess one thing I want to bring up at this point to kind of get it back onto Jordan Peterson was that when Peterson became famous, and I think this was in, 2017 was when he really kind of arrived on the scene, after Trump was elected. He became famous at a moment where there was a lot, there had been actually, even before the election of Trump, a lot of animosity online between people who were concerned about political correctness, say, and between people who were concerned about fighting for equality and social justice, or, you know, the shitlords and the social justice warriors were at war with each other online. And I would say Peterson's popularity in 2017 was largely due to the fact that there was a hunger for someone to come along and make the case against, whether it be feminism or socialists or trans rights people or, you know, people who are concerned about, like, anti-racist activists. They really wanted someone to come forward to make a strong case against not the struggle for anti-racism in the abstract, say, but against these kinds of people that they didn't like online, right?
Right.
And when I saw him become popular, I felt like it was a sign of the weakness of the left, and that the responses to him were particularly bad at first. Since then, he's sort of self-destructed, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that towards the end. Not that we have any inside information on his health, but I do want to come back to that point. But do you feel as though your book might contribute to not only a solid critique of Peterson, but a way to help the left overcome some of the weaknesses that brought Peterson out as a major figure for a little while? Well, either one of you can answer that.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I think we both have thoughts on this. Do you want me to start?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, first off, I do want to say that there's been a lot of ways to try to respond to the accusation that the left is puritanical, dominated by social justice activists, and committed to kind of PC and cowboy culture. One of the ways of doing that is just to deny that this is a problem, or to suggest that if it is a problem, it's so peripheral that right-wing media is almost solely responsible for bringing it to the public conscience by exaggerating it, focusing on it relentlessly, and so on. And that certainly is true to an incredible extent. I mean, Peterson himself has profited a lot by kind of nitpicking or analyzing these very peculiar instances of what goes on at elite American and Canadian universities and kind of amplifying them into this existential threat to Western civilization. And you have other people like Dave Rubin or Ben Shapiro who pretty much made very lucrative careers off of doing this. And I think it's silly, and we'd all be better off if it kind of took a rest for a time. And saying that, I do think that this is a problem on the political left. And I think it was, again, very well expressed by Mark Fisher in his classic essay, Exiting the Vampire Castle, which has recently been invoked by people like Michael Brooks in his new book, Against the Web, which is fantastic, and I really hope everyone reads it, where, you know, there's this idea that there are some people on the left who tend to dominate the discourse, or at least are framed as dominating the discourse, and they have a priest desire to excommunicate, an academic pedant's desire to be right and to be the first to know to be right, and a kind of hipster's desire to be in the vogue and in with the crowd. And I think that there was a real hunger for someone to confront these people. And my sincerest wish is that it would have been somebody on the political left who would have said something and provoked the kind of change that was necessary before you started to see all these reactionary figures emerge. Not, you know, limiting myself to any kind of blame here, because I didn't do anything about that myself, right? So Peterson, in some senses, was reacting to a serious problem on the part of the left, because the left wasn't actually dealing with these issues itself. And what I think we need to do at this point is not necessarily acknowledge where he's right, but recognize that he's a symptom of a desire for a more inclusive, emancipatory, funny, and universalistic left, a cosmopolitan left, as Brooks says. And I think that's what we need to be trying to build, rather than one that's committed to living in the vampire castle. And the challenge, I think, of achieving that is making sure that you don't abandon the struggle for women's equality, calling out rape culture, racial equality, advancing LGBTQ rights. And how to go about doing that, I think, is something we'd have to talk about some other time, because it certainly goes well beyond the purview of this book, though we both have plenty of ideas, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, I agree with what you said, and I just wanted to say that there was someone in the left, there's been someone in the left that's tried to address this PC, you know, Slavoj Žižek.
Yeah.
I will have to say that's why he's problematic for the left, right? For a lot of people, he's they dislike the way he does it, but I would say, and I also mentioned Žižek because I wanted to address something that he says in the introduction of the book, which is precisely that Peterson is most dangerous,
yeah,
not for what he kind of wrongly says, but for those things where he's actually right. And I think this reflects exactly on that failure of us on the left to address these issues, right? Because some of his uneasiness and his concerns about social justice warriors, right, and PC driven people is precisely that, right? He's not lying. I'm pretty sure that all of us here can name someone, right, that we've encountered that has shut us down or has, like, you know, addresses, like, and then this is people on the left, right, that they are like, have this maybe totalitarian dispositions or discipline. No, I don't call it totalitarian. That's wrong. I call them like disciplinary dispositions, right? Like,
it's all that for
yeah.
No, you know what, guys? I want to throw something on the screen here, because a little while ago, when we were discussing intersectionality, Daniel Deweese.
I love that image, by the way. That's awesome.
Yeah. And it was a $5 super chat. I want to encourage people to, you know, ask questions in a bit. We're going to take questions. But and also, of course, to use the super chat function, because the more super chats we get, the more secure my job is. and the better that we are doing.
Gotta maintain petty bourgeois status, right, Doug?
It takes a while. I don't want to have to, you know, try to go out to work in this environment. I can't. I'm stuck at home. All right. But I was asked here about the J.P. Jordan Peterson Convention in 2018, which I attended as a part of, and they were asking me to summarize the panel and debate that occurred there. And I was thinking, which panel are they thinking of? And then it suddenly clicked. Oh, yes, the one about intersectionality. So if for me, perhaps a great example of the kind of problem that there is on the left is summed up by the intersectionality panel that I was on at this Jordan Peterson convention in 2018. I had released a video about intersectionality, saying that while it was important to be intersectional in our thinking and within the context of modern life under capitalism now, that intersectionality in and of itself wasn't going to change the coordinates of our society, and we needed to break with, you know, the value form and all, in my usual pitch, right? On my usual Marxist orthodoxy. And this was considered
that's enough that we decided to submit two books to you now, Doug. So it's not a bad pitch, you know?
Yeah. So this video was very controversial. At the time, a lot of people were tweeting about it. And I actually had an argument with a YouTuber who at this moment's name is escaping me, which just goes to show that I'm getting older, because I should absolutely know. Peter Coffin is who it was. So we were going to have a discussion about it in this panel, but it turned into more like a struggle session. In fact, it was called a struggle session, kind of somewhat ironically, but in the end, not so much. So it was me, I was on the panel, and then everybody else on the panel was there to help me understand where I'd gone wrong. So I would just say that moment at the Jordan Peterson conference, which was brought together in order to try to provide a critique of Jordan Peterson, and to demonstrate that there could be a left which wasn't mired down in this particular radical particularism, nonetheless ended up kind of creating this moment, which, you know, I think far outstripped that viral video of the DSA people saying don't clap and things like that. So anyway, that's my summary. Hope you got your final thoughts on that. So let's see. I want to get back into, okay, here's what I want to ask you guys both at this moment, which is, do you think that because Peterson ended up to be kind of a symptom of a historical moment, that his work and is going to end up being forgotten and maybe doesn't warrant as much attention as people like myself and you were wanting to give it? Or do you think that even though Peterson's star is fading, that nonetheless the people like him are going to continue to be around, and that we have an opportunity still to understand what's going on behind the scenes with him, or in other words, what brought him into being, and to adequately address it, both by addressing his work and addressing ourselves? And I guess that's a very softball question, but I'll give you a chance to kind of elaborate on your answer, sir. So.
Yeah, I think that the conditions that made Peterson possible are still there, mm-hmm. right? Like all the problems within society, like, are still there. So if it was not Peterson, I'm pretty sure there was gonna be someone else, right? Like, and if Peterson leaves, and if his fame eventually fades, considering, as you mentioned, we don't know how healthy he is, like. So even if he takes like a step back from all of this because of what he, for personal issues, you know, I think just like these sentiments will still not fade, right? And just to make a comparison, for example, I had an argument this with a friend that she told me, oh, it was better that if Hillary Clinton win instead of Trump. And I told her, like, no, because all the sentiments that will get Trump elected will still be there in American society, right? Like racism and stuff. So again, as you mentioned, Matt, and you mentioned Peterson bringing the symptom just doesn't get rid of the underlying condition, right? Like, is this uneasiness towards like all the change that's going on in the world? And as Matt said, he and many of his acolytes and people that think alike are the product of this like postmodern culture or society in which we are still living, right?
Yeah, and I should add, I actually took a little bit of inspiration, you'll be happy to hear this, Doug, from Marx on this book, as you know. So one of the things that Marx was very gifted at, and we should all seek to emulate, I think, is that he was able to combine engaging with very particular and historically significant figures for the time, and criticize their work very effectively, while at the same time trying to engage in more grand theoretical products to understand the underpinning structures, underpinning material relations, more specifically, of, you know, the epoch in which he lived. And I think that's what we tried to accomplish with this book. It wasn't meant to be a kind of grand theorization of the postmodern condition and the problems underpinning it and how to deal with these grandiose difficulties. I mean, that's for another book. What we really wanted to just do was a substantive engagement with a very particular figure who is a symptom of his time and offered the left useful intellectual tools for dealing with his positions. And I do think that Marian's right, that this will be useful even if Peterson does actually happen to fade away. And I should say that I do wish him good health. You know, certainly addiction is not a small problem, and you know, it's not something to laugh at.
I guess I'll jump in and say what I've heard about Peterson's condition is that his detox was intense enough to cause him some damage, and that he's in recovery from the recovery, and you know, he's walking again. There was some video footage of him in his, you know, in his front yard with a remote control car playing with that. But he looked a little gaunt, and he looked, you know, like he was, he's not fully well. So I will hope that he recovers for his own sake. But I don't, I also kind of hope that if he does fully recover his health, that he doesn't re-enter the public domain or try to the public realm, you know, get a lot of publicity and go back on tour. Because I frankly think that the way he became famous contributed to his decline in health.
Yeah, my understanding is he's writing a companion book at this moment to 12 Rules for Life. Actually, we were joking the other day on our kind of thread because he's hiring for a social media assistant to promote the book. And we told the guy who designed the cover to Myth and Mayhem that he should apply for it, since he's now got lots of experience dealing with the Petersonisms, and you know, he produced this cover and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine we'll hear about that more in the future, whatever it is, 13 Rules for Life or 12 Rules Redux or whatever. But you know, so I think that's
so. Marian, I want to ask you one question from that list that I sent you. I didn't get to really hardly any of them. I guess there are two that I might want to ask you here, but the most controversial question is this one. When you, in your essay, you talk about how Peterson tries to insist that radical feminists are, you know, basically trying to create chaos in the world, and he sums up feminism itself as this kind of radical feminism that's destructive. But you'd also go on to say that, you know, these demands of feminism aren't necessarily radical, and that they, you know, for instance, include the right to be treated equally in, before the law, you know, some pretty, you know, typical demands for freedom and rights that in the tradition of liberalism go back, you know, to the early 19th century. I mean, these are not outlandish demands at all or particularly radical. And from a certain perspective, they're not radical anyway. But the one thing that I wanted to bring forward was you also said that people have the right to be addressed by the pronouns that they choose, that shouldn't be considered radical either. And I guess I want to ask you what your response would be to Peterson's typical objection, which is that when you're talking about someone's right to be addressed in a particular way, that does become an injunction for other people to talk in a particular way, and that one person's right to be addressed by their chosen pronoun is an impingement or a violation of the rights to someone else, of someone else who wants to be free to speak, and based on their own understanding of the world. In other words, if you're someone who's a traditional, I don't know, Christian or Jew or a traditional religious kind of person, you might have a very fixed understanding of gender and not be and feel that your religious freedom and your freedom of expression was being curtailed if you're made to use the they pronoun, for instance. So how do you try to settle the conflict between these two opposing rights?
Yeah, I think it's a very like difficult question, I have to say, and I only have like a tentative or provisional answer. because I certainly am not a type of feminist or like activist for trans women that would like, if there's any sort, because I'm not a person inclined to see like this as, for example, part of a, as I mentioned before, like a disciplinary mechanism that needs to be enforced on the side of universities or the government. I don't think that's the way to go. Although sometimes I think, as you sometimes joke about the gulag, that sometimes without these disciplinary right mechanisms, people tend not to follow what is expected from them, right? Because there is no punishment, but etc. Like, again, as a Foucauldian, I try not to endorse this, like, we have to punish if you don't do it. But I think at the same time that the right comes first, because it kind of, this Hegelian vein is it has to do with recognition, right? Like, recognition for me takes precedence, right? Because it's like, I'm gonna be wrong in this, but for me it's like your name, right? People cannot tell you that you are imposing your name on them. That's your name, right? Like, maybe you don't like it, and we can have an argument of whether or not your name was given to you, right? And etc., right? But when people call you some other than your name, right, or the name you go by, you will tell them, well, right, like, that's not my name, and you're not imposing something on them. I understand that in here, as you said, it has to do with other set of beliefs. What about like people in like traditional communities, right? But, right, like, their set of beliefs is like denying you your right to be recognized, right, as an equal to the other person. So I see they're like, when people use that argument, but, oh, this is violating my religious beliefs, I think they are using just the argument of that violation in order to, right, like, impose, like, power and treat this like, you know, this dialectic master-slave, right? Like, you are denied recognition, and therefore, right, you are, like, at top of a hierarchy in which you are not letting someone fully autonomy of themselves, because being able to receive that, like, to be called on that pronoun builds their identity. So I think that takes precedence just because of that, because for a lot of people that they want to use a they pronoun is about being able to be, you know, autonomous individuals. And when you're not doing that, you're denying them that part of their existence. So I think that should take precedence. Although, as I said, I want to be very clear on this, I don't enforce any form of disciplinary measure. Although, as I said, I also don't trust people. So, but in that last part, I still don't have an answer. How do we get people to, you know,
I guess just to go to the name example, I don't feel as though I should have a legal right to insist that people call me by my name. Like, if somebody doesn't like me and they want to give me a nickname or call me, hey, schmuck, I don't feel like I have the legal right to insist that they don't do that as an individual. But then we're not really talking about individual to individual when it comes to the pronoun usage, because this was about, I think, put in the context of a human rights law, it was about having access to a place to live, work, education. So then you're talking about institutional demands rather than demands on institutions to protect individuals rather than demands on individuals. So you, like, an individual might not have any be compelled to use the pronouns of your choice, but a college professor at a public university would be, or someone who is in government would be, or someone who is your landlord would be, in order to protect your rights to, you know, education, employment, housing, and so forth. I think that would be the way that it might be argued out. that these institutions don't have the same free speech rights as individuals anyhow. So that would be my quick argument. I don't know, though, if I totally even believe in that kind of argument, because then you have the problem of the right to free association and the right to create institutions that have their own values. And, so if you run a religious school that isn't publicly funded, do you have to follow the same regulations and human rights codes that public schools do? These kinds of issues come up. But anyhow, I'll let you maybe respond to that if you have any more thoughts on it.
Can you let Matt answer a question so I can give like a thought?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah,
this is like a dense.
Well, let me ask you something, Matt, which is actually, I tell you what, why don't we do this? Why don't we start to take some questions from the chat? We've been talking for about almost an hour. We're 10 minutes shy of that. This is a good time.
I wanted to say, I was a bit surprised when she was bringing up Hegel and recognition that there wasn't a part of your brain that was just circling around being like, got to make this bow to Marxist dialectic. Got to turn this to Marxist dialectic.
No, I mean.
Idealism, no vulgar idealism.
Right. No, well, yeah, I mean, I don't know about the... I'm not sure I agree with your interpretation of recognition from Hegel either, but that goes into the weeds. Because my understanding of Hegel and the struggle for regulation for recognition is that it's a struggle to the death, that the desire to be recognized by the other isn't just like an intersubjective negotiation between supposedly or theoretically equal subjects, but rather a battle to the death for the right to be recognized from the other. That's what it's like that's what it seems to be in Hegel's phenomenology. And weirdly, the one who wins the struggle for recognition ultimately loses the self, their self and their identity in the process, because by destroying the other, subjectivity or rights, or by winning and dominating them, they no longer have the power to recognize you.
So, well, I think there are more moderate forms of that philosophy that you can find espoused by people like Charles Taylor, who's kind of
They're just wrong, though. Well, the other people might espouse things all you want, but no. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because I actually think that this would speak to the kind of point that you're getting at, right? Because one of the things that Taylor points out is that there's a different stringency of norms depending upon what context you happen to inhabit. And this is usually associated with different levels and different forms of power that are operative in these different domains, right? So, for instance, when you're in a family, there's a very strong demand for recognition from your peers. That's kind of appropriate in that social sphere because you have a certain relationship with these individuals, and the kinds of demands you can make for recognition are a lot stronger than what you'd find in others. Though the unusual thing, of course, is that in these kind of situations, we often don't demand that power, particularly state power, be the one that mediates this because that would be inappropriate and to a certain extent would vulgarize the relationship between individuals and their parents or their brothers or sisters or whatever. And I think in the context you were talking about, like the public sphere, we can certainly talk about why, even if there shouldn't necessarily be a legal expectation that you should identify people according to the pronoun of their choice, nonetheless, it should be very stringently enforced as a matter of moral, enforcement. Because in these kind of circumstances, if you're acting as an agent of the public sphere, you're expected to represent the vision, not necessarily of yourself, but of the demos, the people as a whole, which includes the individuals that you're interacting with who want to be referred to by the pronoun of their choice. And by denying them that, you're essentially abnegating your responsibility as a public servant and choosing to speak instead as a private actor who is committed to your own particular moral vision of the good life. And I would say that that's a very wrong thing to do. And I don't think necessarily it should be prevented by law. And there are a lot of different multicultural reasons for that we can get into. But I think certainly the expectation should be that if you are a servant of the public, you're going to refer to a member of the public according to the terminology that they would prefer.
So does Jordan Peterson have any lectures on any lectures on Hegel?
Not as far as I know. I mean,
not that I know.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. He has some interesting ones on Nietzsche and Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard was a very famous critic of Hegel, which might be of interest if you're kind of trying to figure out how Peterson might have interpreted, you know, these Hegelian themes. But none that I know speaks to him directly. Yeah. It's kind of odd, actually, because Peterson himself often associates with the tradition of American pragmatism. People like William James, Peirce, John Dewey, and you know, I suppose you could talk now about Richard Rorty. And interestingly enough, all of these people were highly influenced by Hegel. So it's a bit of a idiosyncratic gap in his scholarship. And I would be interested in knowing what he has to say on that, certainly.
I was muted. That was a mistake. One thing about back to Hegel and the recognition question, I interpret that section of the phenomenology, the master and slave dialectic, not to be making sociological claims about how people actually function in a modern bourgeois society, but more of a philosophical argument about the nature of identity and subjectivity, and also an historical argument as well, which is a little harder to work out, but but having to do with the way that something like a slave morality or a Christian morality rose up after, you know, after the fall of Rome and Greece, and the shift away from a Greek culture into a Christian one, is what I think is there as well. And that I'm not exactly sure how that, you know, whether that's there's a real historical argument there, but more of a kind of a characterization of the difference between the Greek kind of society and the Christian one that came after. But here's another question someone paid for. So in your essays, do you address Jordan Peterson's criticism of collectivism over individualism?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Conrad devotes a lot of attention to that in his essay, which focuses a lot on the kind of problems with Peterson's analysis of Marxism. And my own kind of interpretation of this, giving it my own kind of idiosyncratic spin, one of the things that I argue about is that his theory of individualism is surprisingly thin in many respects. And one of the ways in which it's notably thin, of course, is, and Doug, you probably appreciate this, how he doesn't take into account the limitations are material conditions imposed upon the expression of our individual identity. And the reason that he does this, of course, is if he actually was to interrogate this sphere of life, the material relations that pose an inhibition on the realization of our individuality, it would probably lead him to a critique of capital very, very quickly. And interestingly enough, in the psychoanalytical tradition, when you see people like Adorno and Fromm and Marcuse, who actually took this problem seriously from a psychoanalytic standpoint, this is eventually what they gravitated towards. And Peterson doesn't want to go there. And I think it's another very serious gap in his scholarship that almost begs to be filled, right? What are the ways in which our contemporary one-dimensional capitalist society inhibits the full realization of human potential and the establishment of individuals who are actually able to realize their fundamental capacities rather than just try their very best to establish certain competitive attributes that will allow them to get ahead in this highly stratified and alienated hierarchy?
I have flashed a rude question from one of the people on the screen when I was trying to block them from the chat. So my apologies to you, Marianne.
No worries. I'm very comfortable in addressing that question. My father was actually the one who taught me how to clean and cook, and I choose not to do it.
But I just want you to know that what my intention there was to kick that person off out of the chat, and instead I put it on the screen for a minute. So my apologies there. But yeah, I'm you know, no one ever taught me how to cook and clean particularly well. But I do consider myself to be a real woman. And a real man.
How could you not be a real man with that beard? You know what I mean?
Yeah, there you go.
Right, different hair.
Someone says that I'm based, so that's good. I don't know if they're saying I'm based because I accidentally flashed that on the screen or because I apologize for it. let's see who got kicked. Oh, I forget the person's name who got kicked. Is Jordan Peterson alive? Yes, as far as we can tell, right?
Yes. I don't think he's quite at the Biden state yet, where my secret belief is that he's a puppet that's being reanimated every now and then, right? I think he's still alive in a weakened condition. You know, if he goes full Biden, then God help us all, really.
Yeah, I think Biden technically is still alive as well. It's my theory.
It depends on your medical definition and my interpretation, right?
Yeah, someone says that bearded women are valid, and I would say that's true.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, I don't know what it means to be valid, really, but let's see. What is his appeal to people looking for answers, do you think, Jordan Peterson?
Well, Matt can go deep into this. Maybe I'm pretty sure he will. I think he's dealing with issues like life lack of meaning, right? Like a life void of meaning. I think that has to do a lot with him. I also think like people's desire sometimes for like easy answers, right? Like 12 Rules for Life, right? With easy titles, like very easy explanations. Like I have to say, this is not an insult at all, but as a non-native English speaker, I never had to use, for example, the dictionary to go through the book. So it's a very, like, you know, I think easy to read book, right? So like the fact that he reduces complexity and like it gives explanations to complex issues in a very easy way, I think people always long sometimes for those kind of like answers, right? The ones that just sometimes tell us what to do and how to do it, right? Like do your bed, that's it, right? That will fix the problems.
Someone asks, is Bernie still alive though? And my answer to that is no, unfortunately, he's dead. Also, we need a dad at a time like this, bring Jordan home. And I just want to say, look, I consider myself to be everyone's befuddled Marxist dad. So if you're looking for a father figure, I'm here for everybody.
You need to find a creature substitute, though. I mean, he has the lobster. You know, you're going to need to find... What would it be? Maybe a bear? You know, Marxism and bears.
Everyone's like a GameCube remote. We have to understand ourselves as and align with what the GameCube remote does. And, change and dynamic change is clearly built into the human condition, just like it is into the GameCube remote. That's my lobster. How about that? It's done at random. And someone said Zizek is the best Marxist dad, and I think that's true. Although I think maybe the best Marxist granddad.
I just want an anecdote in that vein. Like I had a college professor. He had a picture of Marx in his office, and then one day this is when I was a student back in college, and then one of our like classmates like walk into his office, saw the picture of Marx. It was like, you know, like in a frame, pretty frame, etc. And then she asked, like, professor, this is a very Marxist professor of us, like, is that your grandfather? So the dad figures, you know.
Okay, well, listen, it's been a lot of fun. We've talked for a little over an hour. I will have you guys back onto the stream again, maybe towards the end of the month or maybe in May. Everyone should go out and find an alternative vendor to Amazon. Don't go to Amazon. Go to Red Emma's is a good one if you're in the United States. Waterstones is good if you're in the UK. There's Powell's Books. But in any case, find a copy to either get shipped out to you or buy the Kindle edition of Myth and Mayhem, A Leftist Critique of Jordan Peterson.
And everyone take care of yourself, right? We know this is a scary time. You know, It's a scary time for us, lots of uncertainties, and we hope all of our readers and even some people, and of course, even Jordan Peterson fans who are logging in, you know, stay safe, you're keeping warm, and yourself, you're social distancing while at the same time not staying in isolation.
All right. I'm going to say goodbye.
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms.